Subsequent to this recording, a press release reported that the Brightline 1 trial investigating Brigham Adlin and dedifferentiated liposarcoma did not meet its primary endpoint. Furthermore, the Phase 3 Brightline 4 study evaluating Brigham Adlin in treatment-naive or pretreated advanced dedifferentiated liposarcoma is currently ongoing and no longer recruiting. Additionally, on August 2, 2024, the FDA granted accelerated approval to afamitresgene autoleucel, a gene therapy indicated for adults with unresectable or metastatic synovial sarcoma who've received prior chemotherapy, test positive for various HLA antigens, and whose tumor expresses MAGE-A4 antigen. Welcome to Oncology Today, Optimizing the Management of Dedifferentiated Liposarcoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Mrinal Gounder from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. To begin, I asked him to provide a comprehensive overview of sarcomas.
So, you know, sarcomas are rare cancers. They're just somewhere in the 16,000 to 17,000 annual incidence in the United States. And this really spans all ages, you know, from infancy all the way to people in their late 80s and 90s. And there's really no smoking gun, per se. So in terms of risk factors, most of these are thought to be, you know, sporadic tumors. And the important thing, I guess, to understand overall in the sarcoma world is that we are moving, even though we're still using the word soft tissue sarcoma and bone sarcomas, I think over the last 10 to 15 years, there's been an explosion of understanding of their basic biology and their molecular genetics. So what basically we're understanding is that even though we lump these all under one term of sarcoma, they're really about 70 to 100 unique different cancers that have very different natural histories from each other, epidemiology, biology, prognosis, and increasingly molecular diagnostics is playing a big role. Because these are rare tumors, diagnosis, correct diagnosis and correct histotyping of each of the sarcomas is very challenging. And even till this day, there's a lot of errors that are being made, and those errors are actually consequential for the patient's outcome. So I think one of the most important thing is when somebody hears that something is a sarcoma, is to make sure that the diagnosis is correct. We actually published a paper in Nature Communications 2 years ago where we reported nearly 10% of patients were getting the wrong diagnosis, and that molecular genetics, such as next-generation sequencing, sort of further aids and refines the diagnosis of sarcoma, which then has huge implications, not just on treatment and prognosis, but also on clinical trial access and making sure they have the right biomarker for the right clinical trials. So I think the big takeaway is that sarcomas are super nuanced. A lot of mistakes are being made in the diagnosis, in the pathology diagnosis. So I think sort of sending these tissue for a second opinion at a sarcoma center of excellence with pathology review there is really critical as a first starting point. I think molecular genetics such as NGS are helpful for some patients, but not necessarily all. It can help certainly with diagnosis, prognosis, treatments, including access to clinical trials in terms of biomarkers. So there's, 75 to 100 different types of sarcomas, but there's about 10 or 12 of them that we see much more commonly than others. And in light of that, today's discussion on liposarcomas, those actually happen to be one of the most common sarcomas. So nearly 10 to 15% of all sarcomas tend to be liposarcomas. Then there's leiomyosarcomas, which are tumors of the smooth musculature. Those are also very common. You know, those are about, again, 15 to 20%. And then there's a handful of other tumors such as synovial sarcomas, desmoid tumors, and things like that, that make up nearly about 60%, you know, just about 7 or 8 of these sarcomas make about 60%. The remaining 40% is where all the nuanced complexities of sarcomas exist, including bone sarcomas, such as Ewing sarcomas and osteosarcomas, which are, you know, still remain to be quite challenging groups of tumors to treat, despite, you know, 5 decades of effort in that space. In terms of treatment, you know, the general paradigm has always been, you know, resect, if it's large, radiate, and go forward. That paradigm, while generally true, it's really highly subtype or sarcoma specific. Not all, you know, especially at sarcomas, you know, at the tertiary care centers, you know, there are patients who may have localized disease, but if they're not able to do lymph salvage surgery or the surgery is more extensive, you know, there are options for neoadjuvant treatments or other things that can make even the surgical outcomes better. There are some tumors like desmoid tumors, which you and I spoke about, where surgery is no longer indicated at all. In fact, surgery makes things worse, except in very rare situations. So the bottom line is that I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all approach to sarcomas. They're very nuanced, and you know, each of the subtypes have a unique way of treating them and approaching them.
Any situations in sarcomas where you really see significant response to therapies? You know, a lot of these trials and using, anthracycline, et cetera, at least from the outside, you wonder whether it's almost even worth giving in many situations. Is there any situation?
The most important thing still remains is that you must give chemotherapy in Ewing sarcoma, osteosarcoma, rhabdomyosarcomas. These are areas where I teach my fellows that if you don't give chemotherapy, you know, of course, in the right situation, you're really doing a disservice to the patients. And this is regardless of the size of the tumor or the location, because those are clearly demonstrated, similar to testicular cancers, that those improve overall survival, that chemotherapy is essential. So that has not changed at all. On the other hand, you know, if you just look at doxorubicin across, which still remains sort of the first line in a metastatic setting or the locally advanced unresectable setting, it's a good drug. We use it quite often. There are other drugs like gemcitabine and docetaxel that's also being used quite often. These drugs do have response activities, improvement in PFS, and as well as improvement in patient-reported outcomes, but they've never really been demonstrated in a classic way to improve overall survival. So that, you know, those kind of studies have never been done. But even when you compare it to other comparators, generally the overall survival, we're not seeing any major improvements in that, which then begs the question is, you know, should we be using novel therapies with novel mechanisms of actions increasingly in the first line setting? Because we know that some of these, you know, the anthracyclines, the gemcitabine, docetaxel, and others can be impactful in a subset of sarcomas in a major way, but not necessarily sort of a one-size-fits-all for all sarcomas. So I think it has implications in not just in patient care, but also clinical trial design for these patients. And also to see, should we be referring patients with these sarcomas to clinical trials earlier in their treatment course rather than wait till the very end?
So another thing here is, it looks like in general, and we mentioned alveolar soft part sarcoma, but in general, you don't see much activity of checkpoint inhibitors or immunotherapy here. Any thoughts about why and any potential avenues to maybe have it more favorable? What about T-cell directed therapy? Any thoughts about immunotherapy?
Yeah, so both are excellent questions. So I think a lot of people have been pursuing the immunotherapy question for nearly a decade now. I think the short answer we can say is that, you know, across all sarcomas, immunotherapies, particularly checkpoint blockade, has been quite disappointing. But within certain types of sarcomas, such as undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma, or also known as UPS, these are tumors that are complex tumors. They have a very rich tumor microenvironment. They typically also have high expression of tertiary lymphoid structures. They have relatively you know, higher expression of PD-1. They tend to have a slightly higher tumor mutational burden. These tumors, along with other like angiosarcoma, especially the ones that are associated with sunlight exposure, those do have a nice response, even a durable response, and even cures checkpoint blockade. So it has to be sort of in the right context, in the right subtype, but the vast majority of sarcomas don't really respond well to checkpoint blockade. You had also brought up a TCR therapy, and just recently Sandra D'Angelo from our group had presented in Lancet about this T-cell engineer therapy going after MAGE, M-A-G-E, and NY-ESO-1. So the MAGE is an antigen that's presented on these one type of sarcoma known as synovial sarcoma. This is a pretty aggressive tumor, and this is something where checkpoint blockades do not work at all. We've tried over many, many years, and it doesn't work. But when you use this T-cell receptor re-engineered therapy targeting MAGE, then we're seeing very durable and deep responses. And in fact, this may be a drug that's, in fact, this drug is now sitting at the FDA for their evaluation. And we should know in the next 2 weeks whether the FDA is going to approve it or not, in the next few weeks.
That's really interesting. So this is like a bispecific?
No, it's not a bispecific. It's basically you take out the T cells now from a patient. It goes
like
to
CAR-T.
It's CAR-T-like, except that this is where the T cells themselves are re-engineered to engage with the cancer in a much more stronger way. And you need to not only, so you need to have the right receptor on the T cells, but you also need to have the right HLA type. So both of those need to match in order for, so then these T cells are re-engineered, and then about, you know, a month or two later, they get reinfused back in. And so this for synovial sarcoma and another disease called myxoid liposarcoma. So we're talking about dedifferentiated liposarcomas today, but something called myxoid round cell sarcomas, which are very, very different between what we're going to talk today. In those two instances, these T-cell receptor therapies have been shown to be highly effective. And this was an oral presentation at ASCO and also published in Lancet a few months ago.
Wow, that was so interesting. They see cytokine release syndrome or any kind of issues in terms of tolerability? Yeah.
Yes, so you do see cytokine release syndrome, but these are generally very well-managed syndromes.
So speaking of naive questions to throw out to you, I'm just going to say this. Do you ever see MSI high? Do you ever see HER2? Do you ever see TROP2 in sarcomas?
Great question. So 2 years ago, as I mentioned, I did a next-generation sequencing study on nearly 8,000 sarcoma patients, and we looked at all kinds of markers on it. One of the things we focused on is MSI. MSI was exceedingly rare. I think it was less than 0.5%. So looking for MSI in sarcomas is truly a needle, you know, is searching for a needle in a haystack. HER2, we've not actually studied it. We've not consistently looked at it. There are sporadic data that's coming out that maybe osteosarcomas have some HER2 overexpression. But what does HER2, and increasingly there are many sort of sequencing platforms that also do RNA sequencing. And when they do RNA sequencing, they send back information saying that, you know, these tumors have a high expression of HER2. You then go ahead and do a IHC testing, and it turns out to be really non-expressors. So what does high really mean? We don't know, because we don't know what the benchmark is in some of these things. There's been anecdotal data on benefits of, you know, HER2-directed antibody-drug conjugates with some responses. But the bottom line is that we are way behind for HER2 or TROP2 in knowing what is the full expression of these tumors, even within one particular type of sarcoma. But there's been a lot of work going on it, and it's moving forward.
So has anyone actually done IHC for HER2 on sarcomas? That's in what the indication, the pan-tumor indication is.
In a sporadic manner, but not in any consistent way. So when we see patients, I'm not sending patients to get their HER2 testing done. And I think as a field, we've never looked carefully, but one of my colleagues here is working on a sarcoma atlas, basically trying to see, you know, where all these ADCs being expressed. But that work is going on. But as a field, we're not routinely checking patients with IHC for HER2 expression.
What about TROP2?
Again, same thing. It's even behind HER2. But again, this is like, you know, Nectin, Claudin, TROP2, HER2.
Right.
All of these are being tested right now. I'm not sure how much many of these will express, because these are mesenchymal tumors, and typically mesenchymal tumors, we don't think of them as sort of HER2-driven tumors.
No, I mean, I know. It seems very unlikely, but just, you know, seems like you could use some help here, but whatever. Maybe it's not going to come from that, but that immunotherapy thing sounds pretty interesting. Anyhow, I think that's a great introduction. Why don't we move forward now and get to the topic at hand? This really interesting agent and topic of dedifferentiated liposarcomas.
Yeah. So as we're talking, you know, as I said, dedifferentiated liposarcomas are pretty, among these sarcomas, they're quite common tumors. And I would say these are about 15 to 20% of sarcomas are liposarcomas. So I think most oncologists, if they are dealing with sarcoma over their lifetime, they will come across liposarcomas. They will come across leiomyosarcomas, Ewing sarcomas, osteo, synovial sarcomas, and undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcomas. These are all relatively common within this rare subtype of tumors. But when you hear the word liposarcoma, you know, there are at least five different types of liposarcomas. And it's very important to know which type of liposarcoma we are focusing on, because the natural history, the prognosis, the way you treat it, and outcomes to treatment are widely variant depending on the subtype of liposarcomas. So the photo is a resected specimen. It's a very large liposarcoma that has been resected. And what you'll see here is sort of this glistening mass that looks like fat. And liposarcomas, since they arise from adipocytes, basically you're taking out these very large tumors that appear like fat. And what's interesting to note is that when patients get scans, you know, say a CT or MRI, these tumors are isodense with fat. So sometimes it's very hard to differentiate what is fat and what is a liposarcoma. Sometimes these liposarcomas are clearly demarcated, but most of the time they sort of have an infiltrative appearance. So it's really hard to know where fat begins and where a liposarcoma begins. So they could be quite intermeshed. So what you're seeing here is a large liposarcoma.
The cross section of that, are you saying that a lot of that is normal fat with tumor cells in it? Or is it mainly tumor cells?
It's mostly tumor cells, but many of these we think are basically adipocytes that have arrested development. So they have issues with differentiation. So whether the stem cells itself in the process of differentiation, they somehow had a dysregulation or differentiation and they could not really move forward as adipocytes, or whether these are adipocytes that were transformed, it's hard to know. But we think mostly these are stem cells, mesenchymal stem cells, that had some kind of a dysregulation in their embryological or differentiation pathways.
When you see patients who come in with very advanced lesions like this, is it usually that they've delayed coming in, or there's been a problem with diagnosis, or it's rapidly developing?
It's a very heterogeneous disease. There are some patients who will have disease that's rapidly progressing. For others, it could be indolent and it can sit around for years, slowly growing, and they may not even be aware of it. And these tumors, they can be in the retroperitoneum. So someone could be carrying like a 30-pound or a 40-pound tumor for quite some time, and just say that, you know, I've been gaining weight. They're going to the gym. They're going to other places. They're trying to lose weight. Eventually, they end up getting a scan that shows a large mass, and then sort of things go forward. But a lot of these liposarcomas, they're found in the retroperitoneum. They're also found in the extremities, and rarely even in the mediastinum. So these are the three sort of locations where you can find these liposarcomas.
And in the mediastinum or retroperitoneum, how often are they resectable?
In the retroperitoneum, well, resectability, I guess, is in the eye of the surgeon. If they are localized and if they are not terribly infiltrative, the most common method for these tumors is to go for a surgical resection, because to date, surgery remains the sort of the most important modality of treating these tumors, because from a systemic therapy, we have not made a whole lot of improvements, and mostly we are using them in the metastatic setting, and the improvements have been marginal at best. So when possible, surgery is the best approach for these sarcomas.
All right, please continue.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning, there are at least five different types of sarcomas. As I mentioned, today we'll talk about dedifferentiated liposarcomas. These are the ones that are more likely to metastasize. These are the ones more likely to recur. These are the ones that most likely will result in worsening of survival. But there's also the well-differentiated liposarcoma. So generally, the well-differentiated and the dedifferentiated, they go hand in hand. In other words, if you see dedifferentiated liposarcoma, generally there's some well-differentiated component in it as well. But we also see nearly 40% of the time well-differentiated liposarcomas. These, as I mentioned, are much more indolent. They're typically in the retroperitoneum. They grow very slowly. And the only modality of treating with these tumors to date has been surgery. Now, so patients will have a big debulking surgical resection, and then we can watch them sometimes for years, sometimes even when it recurs, we can still watch them slowly till it becomes large enough that they need to do another surgical resection. Among this, there is something known as a myxoid or round cell liposarcomas. This is the one that I mentioned where the T cell receptor therapy was shown to be quite effective. These tumors, unlike the dedifferentiated or the well-differentiated liposarcoma, are very, very sensitive to chemotherapies. So these are tumors, say, for example, if you found the same exact tumor in any location, initiating with chemotherapy to sort of reduce the size of the tumor and then go for a surgical resection is preferred. They're also very sensitive to radiation, which, unlike the dedifferentiated liposarcomas and well-diff, which are generally not sensitive to radiation at all, the myxoid round cell liposarcomas are exquisitely sensitive to radiation. So as you can see, just the term liposarcoma has so many nuances within that itself. So here are some of the systemic treatments that we have been using in dedifferentiated liposarcomas. Doxorubicin, which was approved for sarcomas in 1974, still remains sort of the main backbone for many different sarcomas, especially the high-grade metastatic sarcomas. I'm not saying it's the right drug in every situation, but in dedifferentiated liposarcoma, doxorubicin does play a role. Unfortunately, despite us doing studies over the last 4 or 5 decades, most of the data we have in the role of dedifferentiated liposarcomas, especially for doxorubicin in the frontline setting, is all retrospective analysis, which would be shocking to most people. But you can see here, there's been at least 5 different retrospective analyses, both from Europe as well as in the United States, which show that if you use single-agent doxorubicin in dedifferentiated liposarcoma in the metastatic or advanced setting, the response rate can be as low as 0% to typically in the 1%, typically in the single-digit range. So anywhere from 0 to 10% overall response rates can be seen with single-agent doxorubicin. What happens if you combine it with ifosfamide, which is commonly done? You can certainly increase the response rates. Now you can get double-digit response rates, but still somewhere in the less than 20% range with combination of doxorubicin with ifosfamide. But what's important to know is that in the phase 3 studies, which were done, comparing doxorubicin versus AIM or doxorubicin plus ifosfamide, you do see more response rates. You do see slight increase in PFS. And the overall survival also improves, but it's very marginal. So unless a patient is symptomatic or really needs a response rate, we try not to do dual agents because the benefit in overall survival is quite marginal with this combination of drugs. So you have to be careful about when you can just get away with single agent doxorubicin and when you need to do dual agents. But I want you to, this is important that I start off with these slides because it'll play into why some of these drugs are used as comparators. So you can see the median PFS is with doxorubicin, whether it's in the single agent or combination with ifosfamide, is still like 2 months, 1.5 months, or 4 months at best. So it's really quite low. First line setting PFS, median PFS is 4 months. And the overall survival is anywhere from about 15 to 20 months with doxorubicin. So this is in the first line setting. What about in the second line setting? In the second line setting, we can still use gemcitabine and docetaxel. Frankly, you can use gemcitabine and docetaxel even in the first line setting because they've been shown to be comparable to each other. But from an FDA-approved perspective, eribulin and trabectedin are the two drugs that have been approved in the second line setting for patients with dedifferentiated liposarcomas who have already failed the first line doxorubicin or a doxorubicin backbone regimen. And what you're seeing here is really small numbers. So this is a phase 3 study, but one of the subset of that phase 3 study had dedifferentiated liposarcomas, only 45 patients. And of these 45 patients, the study never reported the response rates, but we know that the median PFS is just 2.2 months for trabectedin in the second line setting. And for eribulin, similarly, a very large phase 3 study, but only a small subset of patients, just 31 patients with dedifferentiated liposarcoma. Again, we don't know what the response rate is, but the median PFS was just 2 months. For trabectedin, there was no improvement in the median overall survival. And for eribulin, there was shown to be an improvement in median overall survival compared to dacarbazine in this disease. So essentially, to sort of summarize, for dedifferentiated liposarcoma, when it's locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic, we have single-agent doxorubicin in the first-line setting or combination of doxorubicin backbone, gemcitabine docetaxel, or in the second-line setting, FDA-approved trabectedin or eribulin in this disease. So and what you've seen so far is that the overall response rates are really low. The median progression-free survival is anywhere from 2 to 4 months, whether it's in the first line or second line setting. There's really no major improvement in overall survival that we've seen with these drugs. So essentially, it begs for novel therapies in this disease. So in terms of novel therapies, what should we be talking about? And we are going to be talking about a gene known as MDM2. Most people have not heard about this. Most oncologists have not heard about MDM2 because we really don't have any FDA-approved drugs going after this target. But it's worthwhile to just take a few minutes to try to understand what is MDM2, what role does it play in cell signaling, in cancer cell signaling, and how can we take advantage of this molecule? But more specifically, what does MDM2 play in liposarcomas itself? So in order to try to understand MDM2, we really need to talk about P53. So as we all know, we've been talking about P53 since 1979, so almost 5 decades of research on P53. And everybody knows, every medical student and biology student knows that 50% of all cancers have some kind of a mutation that inactivates P53. So as we all know, P53 is the guardian protein or the guardian tumor suppressor gene of the genome. So 50% of cancers have mutations P53 that results in a numerous sets of dysregulation, and essentially its tumor suppressor gene is no longer effective, and these tumors then begin their cascade of becoming oncogenesis. That's one of the first initial steps for oncogenesis. But then the question is, if 50% of tumors are mutated in P53, what's happening in the other 50% of all cancers? And it turns out that the remaining 50% of most cancers have an intact P53. They have wild-type, intact, functional tumor suppressor genes. So then the question is, well, if they have intact P53, how come they've developed cancer? And that's where we start talking about MDM2. It turns out that tumors that have P53 wild-type, they tend to have an amplification over or an overactivation of MDM2. So what is MDM2? MDM2 is a protein that is the most important negative regulator of P53. So what I mean by that is MDM2 is a protein that basically turns down P53. And it's, in other words, it's this negative regulator of P53. So in many of these tumors where P53 is wild type or not mutated, it turns out that MDM2 can be overactive. So when MDM2 is overactive, essentially what it's doing is it's shutting down P53. So P53 is no longer functional in these tumors, even though the P53 at the DNA level is actually a wild type and completely intact. And the problem there is that MDM2 is overexpressed and it's essentially shutting down P53.
I noticed you had a paper, I think, on selinexor, and there's some work that I saw in endometrial cancer looking at selinexor and P53 wild type, and I never exactly understood the rationale there. Can you kind of explain that to me? And does, theoretically, how would selinexor affect this model?
Oh, what a great question. What a great and super insightful question. Thank you for asking that. So, so selinexor is a XPO1 inhibitor. So XPO1 is a nuclear export inhibitor. So it turns out that, in the cell, you have the cytoplasm and then you have the nucleus. But how do proteins go from the nucleus into the cytoplasm for proteolytic degradation? And in order for proteins to transport from the nucleus back into the cytoplasm, they need XPO1. And XPO1 is this nuclear export or a nuclear exportant. It turns out P53 and MDM2, they actually have a small region in the protein itself that is specifically binds to XPO1. In order, after they bind, these gets translocated from the nucleus into the cytoplasm for proteolytic degradation. Selinexor inhibits XPO1. So essentially what it's doing is it binds XPO1, it prevents MDM2 and P53 from being degraded. So in other words, it traps, selinexor traps wild-type P53, it traps MDM2 all within the nucleus, causing the nucleus basically at the nuclear level, it looks as if there's a huge accumulation of P53, which then triggers apoptosis or senescence or quiescence. So in endometrial tumors, when you say, what does selinexor have to do with wild-type P53? You need wild-type P53 in order to get trapped. Selinexor traps the P53 within the nucleus, preventing it from getting degraded, and then induces apoptosis or senescence in those tumors.
When you look in general at P53 wild-type solid tumors, what fraction of them are MDM2 positive? And where Perfect. That's theoretically a mechanism, I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. No, that's a great question, and that's my next slide, which is saying that essentially 20% of all solid tumors will have MDM2 amplification or some kind of an alteration. So this is a very vast number of tumors that are dependent on MDM2, and nearly all of them will have wild type P53. In other words, for a cell, there is no benefit to have a P53 mutation and an MDM2 amplification. It's a redundant system. So either you have an MDM2 dysregulation or overexpression, or you have a P53 mutation. But generally, cells don't tend to have both of them. So just looking at the things, as you know, liposarcomas, nearly 90% of liposarcomas, I would say it's a universally MDM2 is amplified in all these liposarcomas, and P53 is rarely mutated. In lung cancer, nearly 10% of lung cancer has MDM2 amplification. They have P53 wild type. Prostate, 7%. Breast, 5%. GBM, a whopping 25%, have MDM2 amplifications. Head and neck cancers, bladder, everything is sort of 10% or so, have high levels of MDM2 amplification and wild type P53. So clearly this is a mechanism that spans beyond sarcomas. But in liposarcomas, it's a very enriched population. It's an enriched disease and the perfect disease to study MDM2 amplification in the background of a wild type intact P53. So this is, as I mentioned before, we did this huge study in published in sarcomas, nearly 8,000 patients with sarcoma who underwent next gen sequencing. And what you're seeing here is essentially that P53 and MDM2 are mutually exclusive. And this is a heat map. But right here, this brightest orange here, you're seeing MDM2 amplification. But if you just scroll right up there, you will see that P53 is totally intact. There's no mutations there at all. And that's why it's clearly white over there. So this is essentially to show that both P53 and MDM2 are mutually exclusive in terms of mutations. So this next leads to the question of, well, can we now inhibit MDM2 inhibitors? Because as you know, inhibiting P53 has been nearly next to impossible. We've been trying to do this for 30 years now, and it's very hard to repair that missense mutation P53, right? Because you are essentially losing protein function. How do you restore activity? And we've not been able to give a drug to restore activity of P53 when it is initially mutated. But if you have MDM2 overamplified, we can certainly think about how we can shut it down. And by shutting down MDM2, we can now reactivate P53 in order to do what it's supposed to do, which is a tumor suppressor gene. And this concept is not new. I know we are talking about MDM2 inhibitors here in 2024, but these class of drugs, you know, have been evaluated now for nearly 25 years. So going back to the early 2000s, or, you know, the first drug was this something called Nuplin, which came out from Roche, which was the first MDM2 inhibitor. And this was a study about 106 patients with all kinds of tumors, non-selected. So this was going back 25 years ago, non-selected. And it really, out of the blue, people found that there was activity in liposarcomas, and people didn't fully understand what was going on. To some extent, they did, but, you know, it was not fully fleshed out. But one thing that since then, after Nuplin, there were many other MDM2 inhibitors that have been developed by pretty much every large pharmaceutical company, because, you know, it's 20% of all cancers can potentially be targeted. So it's a huge population and a huge market for drug companies. But, and many of these phase 1, phase 2 studies have been done, and pretty much all of these studies have come to a standstill or have been abandoned at some point. And the number one reason all of these studies have not really moved forward is because of thrombocytopenia. Okay. So, and what happens with this thrombocytopenia are that this is a pretty profound thrombocytopenia where initially the patients are fine for cycle 1, cycle 2, they're starting to get some benefit. By the time they go into cycle 3 and cycle 4, their platelets start dropping. And their platelets start dropping. And unlike many other chemotherapies, and we're like, well, what's the big deal if platelets drop? These platelets don't pick up for a really long time. So they can go down to 30,000, 20,000, and stay at 20, 30,000. They can go on for 2, 3, 4 months, or even longer. So what happens is all these studies, we're starting to see some activity, you know, during cycle 1, cycle 2, some side effects, and then the platelet issues start cropping up. And then sooner than later, patients' disease starts progressing because you can't treat these patients while they have thrombocytopenia. So on one hand, your hands are tied because you're waiting for counts to improve. On the other hand, the patient is getting worse every week. So many of these studies, essentially all the major pharma companies went into the space, and then eventually a few years into it, they gave up. About 10 years ago, we started this study with another MDM2 inhibitor. And we started, essentially, we did a phase one study in solid tumors and lymphomas. So this study started back in 2013. And just like any other sort of any other study, this study looked at many different doses and it looked at many different schedules. And just like all the other preceding studies prior to this, this study also was dosing the drug every single day. So all of these studies, for the most part, were giving the drug on a continuous basis, or they would give it 14 days on, 7 days off, or 7 days on, seven days off, or something, some sort of a schedule like that. And after 2 or 3 years of doing the study sort of on a daily basis, it turns out that this also had very high degree of thrombocytopenia and anemia. And as you can see here, the grade 3 thrombocytopenia was 35% in these patients. And as I mentioned before, this is not a grade 3 thrombocytopenia that recovers in time in order to dose the patient again. So essentially, we were in the exact same spot as any other sort of drug that has been evaluated in this space. But one critical decision that was made by this company along with all the investigators is we said, you know, maybe we should think about giving this drug in an intermittent way, just the way we think about giving chemotherapy. We would not give cisplatin every single day. We would not give doxorubicin every single day. Why are we giving these drugs every single day? And I think a lot of this is because we give imatinib every single day. We give, EGFR inhibitors every single day. So the paradigm and the thought process was, let's give these oral drugs every single day as well. But in hindsight, it was one of the best decisions we made, because we said, you know what, we're not going to give it every single day, because it turns out that when you give these drugs every day, you actually end up really damaging the hematopoietic stem cells. The hematopoietic stem cells are exquisitely sensitive to the P53 concentration within them. So if the P53 concentration really shoots up, they actually go under an irreversible arrest. That's why these thrombocytopenia happen. That's why it takes a really long time for these platelets to recover. So the moment we switched the schedule to intermittent, and in this study, we gave it for 3 days on and then 11 days off, and again, 3 days on and 11 days off in a month, the thrombocytopenia, anemia, gastrointestinal side effects, everything dramatically improved. Now, the question you may ask is, well, all that improved, but did the drug actually work on these patients? And I will show you here is that yes, that even when we gave the drug intermittently, but at a slightly higher dose, the side effects were better. The thrombocytopenia nearly was resolved. And even when giving these drugs in an intermittent fashion, the tumors were shrinking. And what you're seeing here is a well-differentiated, dedifferentiated liposarcoma in a patient who was treated and had a nice partial response that was durable for a long period of time. So this led to the MANTRA study. The MANTRA study was the first pivotal phase 3 study in dedifferentiated liposarcoma. This is a global study conducted. And this was essentially milademetan was given 3 days on, 11 days off, 3 days on, 11 days off, continuously with no interruption. And it was compared to trabectedin. And I mentioned to you before that trabectedin is approved by the FDA in the second line setting, and it has a PFS, median PFS of 2 months. And in our phase 1 and phase 2 studies, we saw that this MDM2 inhibitor in liposarcomas was giving a median PFS anywhere in the 7 to 8 month range. I think the correct number is 7.6 months was a median PFS in the phase 1, phase 2. So I think when this study was designed, we were very confident that milademetan with a median PFS of 7 and odd months compared to trabectedin of 2 months was definitely going to beat the second line agent in the setting. And so this is a global phase 3 study, and I'll walk you through the results. So the unfortunately, the progression-free survival was the study did not meet its primary endpoint. Milademetan had a median PFS of 3.6 months, and trabectedin has 2.2 months. So although numerically it looks better, the hazard ratio was not met, and it was not statistically significant. The median PFS was not better. The median overall survival was also nearly the same between milademetan as well as trabectedin. This study was presented by my colleague Robin Jones from Marsden at ESMO last year, and the publication of this is currently we are writing the manuscript to send it out. And again, the side effects from this mantra or the phase three study is something that we saw again in phase one and phase two, really all very expected. We saw nausea, we saw thrombocytopenia and some other GI side effects, but nothing unusual or different than what was reported in the phase one study. So this now leads to the main sort of one of the topics here today is talking about brigamatalin. So brigamatalin is also an MDM2 inhibitor. It was previously called as BI-907828. And this study has been, phase one study has been going on since 2018 onwards in both solid tumors and then with a much greater focus in dedifferentiated liposarcoma. Again, dedifferentiated liposarcoma makes all the sense to test out an MDM2 inhibitor because nearly 100% of these tumors have MDM2 amplification. They all have P53 wild type. So it's the ideal setting, ideal disease to test out an MDM2 inhibitor. So this, the first results, I had presented this in ASCO 2022. Subsequently, many of my colleagues who are co-investigators have presented this at subsequent ASCOs, at CTOS, which is the Connective Tissue Oncology Society, at the Japan Sarcoma Foundation, as well as the British Sarcoma Group annual meeting. So for the purpose of today's discussion, you know, the data cutoff is what we presented at the British Sarcoma Group annual meeting of just earlier this year in Feb of 2024. The phase 1A from this study was actually already published in Cancer Discovery last year in August 2023. So you can certainly read about the further details about this or the phase 1A or the dose expansion portion of this. So just like other MDM2 inhibitors, brigamatalin is same mechanism of action, which essentially is that it inhibits the interaction between MDM2 and P53. And when it binds to MDM2, it basically prevents MDM2 from inhibiting P53. And when MDM2 is no longer binding to P53, P53 is no longer degraded, and therefore the P53 activity goes up. But what's interesting or unique about brigamatalin compared to many of the other MDM2 inhibitors is that it looks to be very potent, and it also has a pretty long half-life. The half-life of this drug is much longer than the milademetan half-life, which is much shorter than the half-life of brigamatalin. Neil?
Can you talk a little bit more, again, to my naive ears about the type of small molecule it is and kind of what it actually is binding and what the difference is between this and the Myla drug you just talked about, and also what happened to that drug? Is that, did they give up on it or are they still looking at it? And also, did any of these look at MDM2 expression and benefit?
Okay. So the first question is just the molecule itself. The molecule is a small molecule. These are all oral taken drugs. The small molecule is, from my understanding, is that it's relatively easy to make because it's not in some deep pocket. So the MDM2-P53 interaction is a pretty flat surface. And since it's a flat surface, many of these molecules are almost look alike. So if you look at the molecular structure of many of these MDM2 inhibitors over the last 20 years, they are more or less look about the same. There's obviously some key differences which plays a role in terms of their pharmacokinetics and half-life. So most of these are, you know, what they essentially does is it binds to MDM2, and that binding prevents MDM2 from then binding to P53. So that's how these drugs work. In terms of the milademetan drug that we previously talked about, That drug is no longer being pursued, at least to the best of my knowledge, in liposarcomas. And there was also a major basket study that was being done in solid tumors that had MDM2 amplification at the DNA level. That study has also been terminated. So I don't know what's going to be the ultimate sort of the fate of that milademetan drug. In terms of expression, no one's really done that yet. I guess in many ways, the lowest hanging fruit has been the DNA amplification of MDM2. So you do a next-gen sequencing, you see MDM2 amplification, and that's pretty much been where things are. To the best of my knowledge, I'm not aware of any trial that is looking at MDM2 overexpression. But we certainly know that tumors that do not have MDM2 amplification, they can also have MDM2 overexpression at the RNA level or the protein level that is not necessarily picked up at the NGS level.
Well, let me put it another way. Did these trials, do you exclude P53 patients?
Yes. So all of these patients, if you have a P53 mutation, they're all excluded. We don't expect, because the P53 itself is not working anymore, even if you were to upregulate it, it's a dysfunctional P53 at the end of the day is not going to help control the cancer.
I'd still call this biomarker-directed therapy, at least at this point. And also, I'm just kind of curious, too, you were saying that the phase one, the toxicity looked pretty good, but it looked like they still had a fair amount of grade 3 thrombocytopenia. Was that like a clinical problem, or you don't think so?
Oh, that's a great question and a terrific pickup. So yes, even when we did the drug intermittently, remember initially everybody did it continuously, but when we went to do intermittently, the thrombocytopenia decreased. But what was very interesting is that it also recovered very rapidly. In other words, we were still able to dose the patient every 3 to 4 weeks, even though we saw grade 3 thrombocytopenia, all of those recovered quickly in the intermittent schedule or the intermittent dosing. When we gave it continuous, those thrombocytopenia took months, if ever, to recover. So that's the critical difference. And I think one of the big major achievements in the field of MDM2 is this understanding that dose matters, but probably the schedule matters even more. So how you give these drugs, it was the difference between moving forward with this class of drugs versus abandoning this class of drugs.
It sounds like a story we've been hearing in breast cancer, a drug called capivasertib. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but it came after another drug called alpelisib, which just had really bad toxicity. So they moved to I think it's 4 days on, 3 day off thing, and they saw a lot less. But the question I had there, and also to you, is how much of an issue is going to be adherence, theoretically, if this goes on, having patients take it, you know, basically for 3 days, twice a month? It sounds a little more
involved.
No,
you're 100% right. I think many studies have shown that patient compliance, even in patients who have life-threatening diseases like cancer, it rapidly declines if you're not doing daily dosing. Right. I mean, when you'd go twice daily dosing, compliance falls. And then now if you're doing it 3 days on and then 11 days off, patients are bound to forget when they took it and when they're supposed to take it again. So it's not ideal. And I think we'll need to use technology and other reminders or wearable devices and other things to remind patients. But compliance is an issue, not because patients are non-compliant. It's because when you take these drugs in this sporadic way, it is a challenge. But what's interesting about this Brigamadalin drug that we are on right now is that it's essentially just one pill every 21 days. Okay. So this is, it's almost like a version 2.0 or version 3.0 of milademetan, which, you know, you were taking 3 on, 11 off. This is just one day, one pill, and then for the next 20 days, you don't have to take anything at all. So it's quite fascinating. And I'm not aware of any other oral drug in oncology that has this kind of a schedule or dosing features.
That's really interesting. Has that always been the schedule in phase one? Same thing?
Yes. they were able to learn from everything that had been presented that not to do the mistake and do continuous dosing. So we went straight to intermittent dosing based on all the lessons we had learned from the milademetan program.
So you went right from that to once every 21 days?
There was initially one, it was day one, day eight schedule. And then we said day one, day eight, they said, well, we'll just try to do, you know, once every 21 day. So it's either once every 21 day or a cycle one, day one, day eight. But eventually the day one, day eight got abandoned. There were some discussions about some other schedules, but all of those were removed in favor of the once every 21 day schedule.
All right, let's continue.
Okay. So in this slide, essentially, we're sort of getting a little deeper into the weeds of brigamadalin, which is a highly potent, orally available MDM2 antagonist. And you know, there's all this, one of the things that you see here is the half-life all the way far down. It's 42 hours. So it's a pretty long half-life compared to any of the other drugs. And it has very, very favorable pharmacokinetic profiling, especially when given in this intermittent dosing schedule. So this was the phase one study. As I mentioned, this started back in 2018. And as you can see here, in the dose escalation, about 54 patients were enrolled. And we looked at two different schedules, both oral. One was day one, every 21 days, and another one was day one, day eight, in a 28-day schedule. And both of these were evaluated. Eventually, the dose that we agreed was the right dose to go forward was this 45 milligram dose given once every 21 days, a single oral pill given once every 21 days. So we saw a lot of, and I'll get into the details of this, but then the phase 1B dose expansion is going on not just in sarcomas, but also in lung cancers and gastric cancers and bladder and pancreas and biliary tract cancers, especially, which have MDM2 amplification. So that's a key thing. There are two separate cohorts. In fact, there are several cohorts in the study looking at many different diseases and their outcomes in this phase 1B. In this phase 1A and phase 1B. The phase 1B has been presented at many different meetings, but has not yet been published. And as I mentioned before, the phase 1A was published in Cancer Discovery last year. Again, just sort of looking at the demographics and the baseline characteristics, so far about 145 patients with solid tumors have received brigamadalin as part of this study. And we are not yet talking about the phase 3 ongoing study. So just as part of the phase 1 study, now, about 145 patients have received, you know, either the day one, day eight schedule, but the vast majority of patients have received the Q21-day schedule. And what we've seen here is that, and I'll get into the data itself. And for the purpose of this conversation, I'll just keep focused on dedifferentiated liposarcoma and not talk about how the other tumors did. But here you can see that this is a nice distribution, mean age of about 60, and many of them with ECOG 0 or 1. And prior median lines of systemic therapy were 2 prior lines of therapy. Again, the side effects are really no different than any other side effects we've seen with any of the other MDM2 inhibitors. Again, this is GI side effects as well as myelosuppression. And as you can see here, nausea, fatigue, vomiting, decreased appetite, diarrhea. The GI side effects are any grade is anywhere from, you know, 50, 60, 70%. But then the grade 3s are quite low, but neutropenia and thrombocytopenia grade 3 is 23% and 26.9% for neutropenia and 23.4% for thrombocytopenia. So it does cause myelosuppression, even grade 3 myelosuppression. But most of these were deemed to be tolerable with adequate supportive care measures. So what about the efficacy of this brigamadalin in the phase 1B just in patients with dedifferentiated liposarcoma? So as you can see here, 79 patients with dedifferentiated liposarcomas were enrolled. 76 of them had an evaluable response. And at the time of the data cutoff, the median PFS was 8.1 months. And I want to stop and just sort of focus on that for a second for the reader, because doxorubicin in the first line setting, the median PFS I had mentioned very early on was anywhere from 1.5 months to about 3 to 4 months at most. So this was nearly a, you know, a doubling or even a quadrupling of PFS compared to doxorubicin. So this was really sort of an earth-shattering data when we first looked at it. What's more interesting is the response rates. Here you'll see that the overall response rate was 19%. Again, when you remember, at least from the retrospective review, the overall response rate to doxorubicin was anywhere from 0% to about 8% with single agent doxorubicin. Only with combination of doxorubicin and ifosfamide do the response rates are anywhere in the double digit, you know, 10, 12, 13, 15% range. So 19% response rates in this very difficult to treat disease patients with a meaningful PFS of 8.1 months was really, really impressive. And this was the rationale to go forward with a pivotal phase 3 study, which is the Brightline 1 study, comparing brigamatalin directly to doxorubicin in the first line setting. But before I go there, I just want to give you this example of a patient with dedifferentiated liposarcoma who was treated on brigamatalin. This patient previously had failed doxorubicin and ifosfamide, had failed eribulin and trabectedin, and came in with an MDM2 amplified dedifferentiated liposarcoma, went on the study, had a partial response of 43% after just two administrations of the drug, brigamatalin, and had a striking response, as you can see here. This patient is a patient of Dr. Patrick Schofsky in Leuven, Belgium, and he had provided these scans for this patient. So going to the Brightline 1 study. So Brightline 1 study is the sort of the first, it's a seamless phase 2, phase 3 randomized study comparing brigamatalin to doxorubicin in the first line setting. And what you're seeing here are two, it's basically a seamless phase 2, phase 3 design. So in the phase 2 portion, nearly 270 patients are randomized in a 1:1:1, either to doxorubicin or a lower dose of brigamatalin, which is 30 milligrams, again, given every 21 days, or a slightly higher dose of brigamatalin at 45 milligrams, which was the dose that we had declared was the right dose in the phase 1. And based on the interim analysis, the winner was selected for the brigamatalin dose, and then that went into a pivotal phase 3 study where 120 patients were randomized in a 1:1 fashion to doxorubicin versus brigamatalin. And here the brigamatalin dose was 45 milligrams, one pill given every 21 days. And the primary endpoint of the study was improvement of progression-free survival. And we're waiting to hear about the outcome of this study. So the Brightline 4 is a new study that is basically looking at treatment naive or even pre-treated advanced dedifferentiated liposarcoma patients. This is outside of the phase 3 study, so there is no placebo, there is no doxorubicin. This is just patients who have wild type P53 and have MDM2 positive or MDM2 amplified dedifferentiated liposarcoma who can enroll in this study. There's about 100 spots for treatment naive patients and about 140 spots for patients who are pre-treated. And again, the endpoint is basically activity and safety of this drug outside of the pivotal phase 3 study.
I was just thinking of the idea of trying to talk to a patient about the phase 3 randomization there against doxorubicin. What would you, I love the patient-reported outcomes. What would you expect to see in the patient-reported outcomes in the first couple months of therapy compared to doxorubicin, I would think it'd be much better tolerated, but you tell me.
I don't know. I mean, in my own clinical experience, the MDM2 inhibitors are not easy to swallow. I mean, the fatigue, the nausea, the drug-induced nausea is real. And in my own experience, I've had to use multiple different anti-nausea medications, including drugs like aprepitant, in order to control the nausea. Fatigue is real. And, you know, the myelosuppression is probably the same, whether you're looking at doxorubicin or bergamotolin. Doxorubicin has its own set of side effects, all of these. So I would guess that the patient-reported outcomes is not all that different. It may be different areas that may be affected. One patient may say, you know, with doxorubicin, I don't like the alopecia and the loss of hair. Another patient may say, I like bergamotolin because my hair is fine. But somebody else may say, you know, the nausea for this drug is maybe worse than what we're seeing with doxorubicin. So I would say it may not be that much superior than doxorubicin from a patient-reported outcomes perspective.
That's a very, very interesting and helpful. I don't know if I was dreaming this or not, because we have a program coming up on biliary tract cancers, but I could have sworn I saw something like 4 out of 7 patients responded to this.
That's correct.
This is agent.
This is the same exact
agent. That's pretty
amazing. Correct. That is absolutely amazing. I agree. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, any particular, biliary, has got all these targetable lesions. Any idea why?
They also have MDM2 amplification. So the biliary tract tumors also have it with the wild type P53. So that's what we think is a mechanism there.
Kind of curious about how many people have you actually treated with this agent?
With bergamotolin, we've had this study open since 2018. So I personally have treated nearly about 30 patients or so with bergamotolin, just with dedifferentiated liposarcoma itself.
Any patients stick out in your mind that had a particularly good response?
Yeah, many patients had a good response. There's another set of disease that we didn't really talk about, but it's the same as dedifferentiated liposarcoma, as the well-differentiated liposarcoma. I think I mentioned this to you at the very beginning. Those are the tumors for which no drug works. The response rate with any systemic therapy is 0%. And the only way to treat the well-differentiated liposarcoma is with surgery. And after a certain point, we say surgery does not work, and then patients are referred to hospice. And what we've seen, patients who come in with this well-differentiated liposarcoma, I have at least 2 patients who've had a partial response that has been durable for years. Of partial dual response. And they've been basically taking this drug with excellent sort of outcomes, and they're once they sort of get used to this drug, their patient-reported outcomes and their quality of life is actually quite excellent, except around the days that they're dosing. So once they move further and further away from the days of dosing, their GI side effects, their anorexia, nausea, everything has a very nice sort of it precipitates and does well. So well-differentiated liposarcoma, which as a medical oncologist, we never see these patients because we don't have anything to offer them. And all of a sudden, we're able to offer a drug in a disease that for which we know no other cytotoxic chemotherapy works. It's really very, very gratifying to offer that to patients.
Hoping for a miracle. I'm hoping that maybe it's been tested in pancreatic, but probably doesn't apply.
Most pancreas tumors have P53 mutations, So I think there may be a small needle in a haystack of MDM2 amplified pancreatic cancer, but it's not a common phenomenon.
How about lung cancer? You said 10% overall. What's the breakdown in terms of small cell, non-small cell, squamous, non-squamous, and non-small cell?
Yeah, so there's a very small subset of small cell lung cancer that has MDM2 amplification, and Charlie Rubin at Memorial Sloan Kettering show that. But the vast majority of small cell lung cancer, this may not be an important modality. In adenocarcinoma, we see about 10% of these tumors do have MDM2 amplification. Interestingly, and I'm not sure whether this has been published or this is just sort of me just looking at TCGA data. It looks like many of them also have EGFR mutated tumors. So they are EGFR mutated tumors to which an MDM2 amplification is also happening. So how that teases apart is hard to know, you know. But there are other, many other tumors. And then, as I mentioned before, GBM, 25% of GBM. But the problem is many of these drugs, it's not clear they cross the blood-brain barrier. So that may be a problem. Even with milademetan, that was one of the issues, is we were not sure how much of this drug gets across the blood-brain barrier and could be relevant in a deadly disease like GBM.
Yeah, when you said 20% of adeno, immediately I was thinking, oh, that's similar to EGFR. But that is really interesting. So any thought about like combining it with an EGFR TKI like osimertinib?
Yes and no. I think there is some data that was published on combining with MEK inhibitors. So MDM2 plus MEK inhibitor as a downstream target seems to be a better, and that's a data that's been published, and I think people have been looking into it. But I think really nobody is going to like do any other studies until these low-hanging fruit have sort of matured and come out. So a lot depends on what's going to come out with Brightline 1. And how positive it is or whatever the outcome is going to be for that study. Once something like this is in the market, then as you can imagine, all kinds of combinations can be imagined.
Really interesting. Yeah. So this kind of reminds me of that desmoid program. I did want to see maybe if you could just provide a brief update on desmoid. You're one of the few people who I turn to in this situation. I think it's been a little while since we chatted. You want to update us on what's new?
Not a whole lot since we last spoke. I think last time when we spoke, the FDA was about to or had just approved nirogacestat, which is a gamma secretase inhibitor. There is a second gamma secretase inhibitor being pursued by another company that is currently has completed its phase 3 clinical trial, and the data for that is going to be maturing in the next year or next 6 months or so. But beyond the gamma secretase inhibitors, the major questions that remain in that disease is how long should you treat a patient with a desmoid tumor? Should you treat them lifetime? Is there a point where you can stop and say this disease is treated? So those are all open-ended questions. And of course, increasingly, as you know, in a desmoid tumor is a disease where overall survival does not matter, you know, because most of the patients are not dying from desmoid tumor. But they do have, you know, a lot of quality of life issues pertaining to their disease. And yet in all these clinical trials, we're looking at PFS as the endpoint. So if you're showing PFS endpoint, but overall survival doesn't matter, then what exactly is that the right endpoint? So the other big thing we are trying to answer in desmoid tumors is, can we get rid of PFS as an endpoint and instead use patient-reported outcomes as an endpoint moving forward? So a lot of like nuances among that disease, but in terms of drugs itself, nothing new, but there are some local therapies such as transarterial chemoembolization of desmoid tumors, or, you know, HIFU, which is high frequency ultrasound of these tumors. Those are all being evaluated in small studies.
That's really interesting. So nirogacestat is approved, is that right?
Nirogacestat approved last November of 2023, and it's now being used, and it's out in the market in the U.S., and I believe it's not yet approved in Europe, but that's something that I'm sure the company is pursuing an EMA approval as well.
Just out of curiosity, do you think it's actually being used in tertiary centers and particularly in the community yet?
Yes. Pretty much now the first drug we're going to is nirogacestat. Patients come in asking for it, inquiring about it, and we can't have any conversation without having that discussion. Unless there's a very strong contraindication for that drug, pretty much most patients prefer, not because it's any better than the other drugs, but, you know, whatever is new and shinier is what patients like to gravitate towards as well. Plus it's FDA approved, so, you know, there's a lot of check marks that go in favor for nirogacestat.
So just remembering back, though, I guess you could say if they need treatment.
Hmm. Yes, if they need treatment, that still remains the case.
That was one thing I learned from you. That was one of the main things I learned from you.
Yeah.
The placebo arm.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. Before I go into every room to see a patient, I tell myself, curb your enthusiasm, you know?
Sounds good.
Yeah.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Gounder, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.